Welcome to World of DAS, a show for data enthusiasts. I'm your host, Warren Hoffman, CEO of Safegraph and GP of Flex Capital. For more conversations, videos, and transcripts, visit safegraph.com/podcasts.
Hello, fellow data nerds. My guest today is Brian Halligan. Brian is the co-founder, longtime CEO, and now executive chair of HubSpot, which is a full-service CRM. They founded in 2006. They went public in 2014. And today they have a market cap of around $23 billion. Brian's also the author of books, Inbound Marketing and Marketing Lessons from the Grateful Dead. And he coined the term inbound marketing as well and helped give rise to one of the biggest shifts in marketing over the last 20 years. Brian, welcome to World of DAS.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Pleasure. And I'm a huge fan of yours. So I'm really excited to dive in. I got a lot of things I want to talk to you about, but one of the things since is top of mind is just boards and outside boards. We're taping this podcast a few weeks after the whole OpenAI thing, which really brought out a lot of different board dynamics and stuff. And you've been tweeting a little bit about some of these boards as well. So one of your top things about board members is to try to find board members who have been operators. Why is that so important?
I think that's important. Sam and OpenAI's case is a little bit different because it really was a nonprofit board. But even as a nonprofit board, it was really funky. They didn't have a bunch of seasoned nonprofit operators on there. They had one person who had been an operator at a nonprofit who had some experience, who had been on boards before. I mean, I can't imagine that somebody couldn't have found a middle ground or calmed things down when there was some palace intrigue. Whether it's a nonprofit operator or a software operator, somebody who had a bunch of experience who was calm-headed, low ego, that could have found a middle ground between all these folks.
But why do operators have a low ego? You could think of maybe a finance person or maybe academic, or why is it the operator that's so important?
I think in this case, they had someone who's from academia. They had three insiders. They had someone I can't quite figure out, sort of a startup person, and then they had a software scale person. I think if they had even just kept Reid Hoffman on the board, if he hadn't dropped off, I can't imagine Reid would have been like, hey, let's all settle down here. We don't have to fire Sam, we don't have to fire Helen. Let's just have some calmer minds. It could have been a VC. Even if Thrive were on the board, I think it would have been fine, or Microsoft. And I just can't imagine they couldn't have calmed that situation down. I have thought about, and I look at a lot of different boards and what works and what doesn't. I don't know if you want to hear, but I have a little rubric.
Yeah, I'd love to hear it. Let's hear it. Let's go for it.
Okay.
What makes a good board?
So I'll tell you what makes a bad board. What is the failure condition for a board? And I'm going to go through a little mnemonic here. F is for friends and family. You don't want any friends or family on your board. A is all late career or all early career. I think a lot of people in tech feel like you should just hire the smartest person you can find. They're first principle thinkers, and they can reason their way through everything. And that has worked really well for HubSpot when we hire management team members. But a little bit of experience helps on a board, I think. And I think it would have helped OpenAI. I, insider overload. There were three insiders, three independents. That was a lot of insiders. L, large boards, greater than 10, I think is a red flag. It's just hard to manage a board more than 10, let's say. U, under the VC's thumb. When you've got all your independents under the VC's thumb, that does not end well for the CEO oftentimes. R, I'm going to throw in rock stars, politicians, athletes, anyone like that that's a press release board hire that you're really bragging about to your parents but doesn't add any actual value to the board. E, large egos, no place for large egos at a board. And then S, small boards, five or less, I think is a bit of a red flag because you can have factions overtake it. If I look at a board, that's the failure conditions of a board.
Let's dive into some of these because some of these are maybe more well-known and people probably agree with you. Let's say boards being too large or something like that. But some of these other things that you talked about are things that are the rock star in some ways makes sense, but then there's certainly, you know, Al Gore was on the Apple board and was probably, I don't know, you think that was a bad board member for Apple? Okay.
I think stay away from politicians because politicians are always going to be running again. You're going to lose them generally. In Al Gore's case, maybe not. I like to avoid secretary of anything.
Okay. Obviously, Henry Kissinger was on the American Express board for many years.
Henry Kissinger was on Theranos's board, and they had three former secretaries of something on that Theranos board. They don't add a lot of value unless your biggest customer is the government. Okay, then you can have, or you've got regulatory issues.
Right, like Raytheon probably has a lot of former secretaries.
Yes, I think that's a good idea. But for 99% of companies, they were from politicians, athletes, rock stars, secretaries of anything, former senators. They just don't have the relevant experience. I don't know. I see a lot of companies do it. I think it's a bad call. You're wasting a board seat.
Insider overload, there's a lot of companies where the founders have a controlling share of the company. Maybe the founders themselves aren't all on the board, but they at least get to appoint the board members. They've got a right to appoint. You think, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think we're just coming out of a phase where the supply of money relative to the quality companies got a little out of whack. And founders were able to really dictate terms through like 2000, 2001 and whatnot. A lot of founders were able to get away with what Zuckerberg got away with. They had special common shares and they had control of the board. I think today that's starting to balance out. And I think founders are going to have a hard time wrestling control from their board, getting those terms. And I think for the vast, vast majority, 99%, Sam Altman's really an exception, Zuckerberg's an exception, that once you take venture, you're going down a path, the board can fire you. It's the deal you're making with the devil. And so if you don't want that, don't take venture dollars, would be my advice to most founders.
If you really couldn't be fired, and I'm playing devil's advocate, and you could think long-term, certainly in the Zuckerberg analogy, he can think long-term. Or I'm not sure if Bezos could have been fired or not by the board, but because he had so many shares, he could really think long-term in this scenario. You want people who can think long-term. And sometimes VCs have different competing interests and they've got funds and they're on their seventh fund. They're trying to raise their ninth fund. They're trying to get some DPI going on there and they might want to sell. I could see how these competing interests would happen.
Yeah, I would argue that, first of all, I just think it's really hard to pull this off in 2023. And if you can't pull it off, which I suspect the vast majority, I would say what you really want are high quality independent board members. Bret Taylor, I think, was a very good pick for Sam. And I have a little rubric for picking great independent board members, not good ones, great ones. And Bret hits all of them. These are my six S's of great independent board members.
Okay, this is amazing. Okay.
One, you want stage expertise. A lot of people want domain expertise, and that's super helpful, but you have a lot of domain expertise around the table with the founders and whatnot, and the VCs typically. You want stage expertise. So what you don't want is, let's say you're on your Series B round of capital. You don't want to hire somebody that spent their entire career at Google or Microsoft. I think of the game of a CEO is like you're an ice climber going up an ice cliff. And when you're picking a board member, you want to pick somebody who's been up that same crevasse, I don't know how to say that word, within the last few years. What you don't want is a board member that started their career on top of the mountain and is still on the top of the mountain and has never been up that path before. So you want somebody a little ahead of you on that path.
Let's say you have five board members or something, or six board members. You want everyone in that stage, because certainly I assume the founders may have not been there yet. And maybe they have, maybe they haven't. The VCs probably have, if you have venture capital, that they've had it. They've seen that stage multiple times. Now you're bringing in one or two people who are more independent. Is it important that those independents also have that?
Yeah. I look at HubSpot back in our Series B. We had two founder seats. Our Series A investor had a seat. Our Series B investor had a seat. And then we had an independent, a woman named Gail Goodman, who was CEO.
Constant Contact.
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing.
She was 3 or 4 years ahead of us on that ice cliff. She wasn't up to the top. She actually probably slipped on her way up there a little bit. But she was ahead of us, and she had terrific domain expertise and stage expertise. I think about HubSpot today, we actually have 3 insiders and 7 independents. When we pick those independents, we're very careful to pick stage expertise. So recently we picked the CEO of Autodesk, who's just terrific. Autodesk is, we're $2 billion, they're probably at $5 billion. He's sort of seen the movie before us. He grew up in here, super, super helpful. We've had for a long time, Jay Simons, who's the COO of Atlassian. Atlassian's...
Yeah, amazing company.
$60 billion market cap, we're 23. He's seen that movie recently. Incredibly effective. Relative, for example, to someone that's always been at Google or Microsoft. I think you want to avoid those folks.
Okay, because a lot of times you'll pick the CMO of a big consumer packaged goods company or something like that.
Not that much. It's just it's a stage mismatch. I think that's the case for executives when you're hiring them too.
Even for, let's say, your public company, you need the head of the audit chair or something, even that type of person?
Yes. So HubSpot's head of its audit chair was the CFO at NetSuite. NetSuite was a classic company for us. They were 3 or 4 years ahead of us. So he's got really good stage expertise in seeing that movie.
Okay.
So that's the first S.
Okay, first S. Got it.
Okay, the second S is smart. And I'm going to give you one of my favorite quotes. It's from a guy named Tommy Heinsohn, who was one of the winningest basketball coaches in history. He coached the Boston Celtics to many championships. And he had a great line. He said, "You can't teach 7 feet tall." If you're Bill Walton, then you're 7 feet, or Robert Parrish, or whoever. It just can't teach that. You can't teach smart. Either someone's smart or they're not. They can learn things, but you see new stuff on a board, and being smart is actually an underrated thing on a board.
And you think just because someone is successful, those aren't correlated?
No. They're correlated, but the R squared on it isn't.
Isn't that high? Is it like you know it when you see it? Like after you met with that person in the end, like if you're like, "Hey, I just spent an hour with this person's clearly smart." And we've all had these conversations where you meet with other people, they have this impressive resume, but they didn't give off the smart vibes to me. Don't bring that person in?
More often than not, I would say. I'm surprised on the downside a lot.
Yeah, maybe I have a high bar for smart. So it's always hard to say, because definitely there's things where other people say they're smart. And I'm like, oh, really?
I'm not saying I'm smart. I listen to your podcast. You have a lot more smart people on. Third one is strong backbone. And this is key. When we had two insiders, two VCs, and Gail as the independent, Gail was tough. And she was truly independent. She didn't give a hoot what we thought. She didn't give a hoot what the VCs thought. She was her own person, and she was making her decisions based on what she thought was right for the company. And at times, VCs will push. I was a first-time CEO. Both VCs were CEOs before. They would push quite hard on me in different things. And if they pushed too hard, Gail would kind of gently push them back, and they listened to her. So having a VC, having an independent that's—
Because she had the credibility— Because you were first time, so you didn't really have your own credibility to push back on them. Okay, that's interesting. And because she was truly independent, if she was in your pocket, they wouldn't have listened to her. So the fact that she was truly independent really helped your case.
I think what usually happens is you're the founder, you just signed up with XYZ VC, and you're looking for an independent. The VCs have a better network to you, and they tee you up with a bunch of terrific people who are actually in the VC's pocket. You need to be a little bit careful there. Because you want someone truly independent, and they have to be smart and independent, because you're exactly right. The Series A investors in at a very low price, the Series D investors in at a high price. You get an acquisition offer 6 months after the Series D. Series A investors are like, let's sell. Series D investors are like, what are you talking about? We're just getting started. That independent director needs to be independent in that case, in many other cases.
Okay. That makes sense.
Third is you should speak 1/n time. In other words, my dad used to say this, if there are 8 people around the table, you should try to speak about 1/8 the time. You shouldn't be speaking 4/8 the time. You should be speaking 1/8 the time. And some people just talk a lot. And some people have huge egos. And oftentimes when you're looking at people for board seats, ego is a problem. It was probably a problem for OpenAI. Some of those board members probably had huge egos. And I think that will mess a board up. And so they're hard to find, but you need very smart people with strong background, with stage expertise, that have a relatively low ego.
Interesting, because I love doing dinner parties where you have like 8 people get together and have a discussion about something. And I always say, you never want one person speaking more than 2/n, 2/n the amount of time. That would be the maximum. You don't want someone speaking more than 25% of the time. Is kind of, and that would be a good dinner party. That means everyone had a chance to contribute and everything.
I think you got it. Stay calm in a crisis. So OpenAI just had a huge crisis. HubSpot's had its share of crises. Every company has crisis. And if things are really calm right now, you're going to have a crisis. It just happens. And some people are very calm and focused during a crisis. And some people lose their shit.
The smart one makes sense. I feel like I can interview and at the end of the hour have some sort of sense. How do you know? Is this just tons of reference checks? How do you know this one?
You reference check. This was hard. I will say we've had some venture folks that freaked out, but generally our independents have been quite calm. I think you can tell if someone's volatile, and you know if somebody's volatile, but I would just say as you're looking at your board, calmness is something very important, because crises happen, disagreements happen, calm is really, really important.
Because sometimes calm and successful entrepreneurs don't always go together. If you think of Atlassian, you don't have a CEO who actually is a pretty calm guy. I know him. But generally, I could see that person might not be as calm.
Yep. You don't want a bunch of alpha dog founder CEOs around the table, probably.
Yeah. Okay.
And my last one is, it's very nice to have a sitting CEO. For me, I was a first-time CEO. It's a very lonely job at the top, and I tried to surround myself with sitting CEOs. So my Series A VC was a former CEO. Series B VC was a former CEO. My co-founder was actually a CEO in a previous life, and then Gail was the CEO. That was just very, very helpful. And I say sitting, which is hard to get, because they stayed current with what's going on. There were CEO of a fast-growing company 10 years ago. It's tough to stay current, and things change very fast. So I like that sitting CEO.
Yeah, there's something about, if you think of maybe the very big things don't change, finding product market fit, managing people, or all the medium things seem like they change dramatically every 5 years.
Even recently, all of the unrest in the Middle East, bam, that's thrust upon the CEO. And are you going to comment? And how are you going to comment? What are you going to say? And how do you manage all your constituents? Right?
Or even just having to comment about political things is relatively new. That's a last 5 year type of thing. That wasn't really true 15 years ago.
So having a sitting CEO who's feeling the pain at the same time, even if they haven't solved it, is actually quite useful.
Yeah. Okay. See, this is why you're such a great marketer. You've got the failure rubric. You've got the 6XS's. You could just tell you're like a great marketer for coming up with all these things. This is amazing.
Thank you. Honestly, I knew we were going to be talking about this. So for the last hour, I just sat down. I know what I'm looking for. I need to figure out a way to describe it. So thank you for having me on to force me out to do it.
In some ways, if you're thinking of, is it avoid the mistakes or avoid the failures, or is it really looking for this amazing gem of a person with these 6 S's?
I think the failures is like you're an investor or you're Henry Ellen Bogan from Durable Capital, and you're looking at a board and you're like, oh, friends and family, X. Ooh, all people who are very early in their career, X. Too many insiders, X. Wow, there's other people in the board, X. They're under the VC, some X. They've got two politicians on their X. Big egos, X. You're grading the board. Somebody should build a little app, boardgrader.com. And the S's is more for, like at HubSpot, we've added a lot of independence over the last few years. We've come up with a little rubric on what we're looking for. And those S's have been very useful to us. We've had good luck so far.
Okay, interesting. Now, you also mentioned that you made this analogy that board members should be parents and not grandparents. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. No, board members should be grandparents, not parents.
Oh, I'm sorry. Grandparents, not parents. Okay. All right. Because I thought the grandparents are the ones that like spoil you a bit, and the parents are thinking in your long-term interests.
Yes. I think they should be like grandparents. I think that's a very important thing. They should act in all the ways we just talked about. The problem with a lot of people who are candidates for board seats that are founders is their greatest strength as a founder turns into their greatest weakness as a board member. And the greatest strength is they're good at making decisions. They're good at controlling stuff. They're good at being very hands on the steering wheel. And they're good at being parents. And that backfires on a board. If you get a bunch of parents on the board gets very dysfunctional very, very quickly. You want them to be more like grandparents, keep their hand off the steering wheel. And only stick your hand on the steering wheel if things are going very, very, very sideways.
Interesting. Now, do you think, based on where you're at, like, do you think your personality is more of a good outside board person? Because you could see how like, a successful entrepreneur, successful CEO could go both ways.
I would say my tendency is the same as I just described. My tendency would be to want to control things and grab the steering wheel and make decisions. And I have to really fight that. And I will say now I'm chairperson of HubSpot's board. Before I took on this role, I called a bunch of other chair people, Brad Smith from Intuit and a whole bunch of other good ones that gave me some good advice. And they all pretty much said the same thing. Be careful. Don't get too involved. Don't grab that steering wheel because you'll screw the company up. And as the founder, you'll undermine the credibility of the new CEO that you brought in. So you have to be super, super careful.
Yeah. Your transition was really interesting because you had somewhat of an unplanned initially transition because you had this very bad snowmobile accident. So you needed someone to step in and then they happened to do a really good job. if you're advising somebody else to do a CEO transition, would you just be like, get into like some serious accident or something? Or how would you advise them? Because I don't know what the lesson is to learn. Your transition seemed like it worked really well, but I'm not sure what lessons the rest of us could learn from it.
It's an interesting story. So in January of 2021, we had a board meeting. And on the agenda of that board meeting was an agenda item: Brian gets hit by a bus. What would happen if Brian gets hit by a bus? Which turns out is a very useful thing to have. So the board's together, we're all chatting about it. And Dharmesh, my co-founder, and I have talked about it before. And I was like, I think Yamini, who's the current, should take over should something bad happen to me. And Dharmesh said, I agree. And the board said, okay, great. We moved on to the next item. Literally 2 weeks later, snowmobile off a cliff, nearly died at the bottom of that cliff, broke 13 bones, was in a hospital for a long time. I really nearly killed myself, not with a bus, but by a snowmobile. And so it's, okay, we know what to do. Yamini takes over. And so I was out of pocket, unconscious for a long time, and she took over. And honestly, it was an interesting moment for me. When I came to, I was like, I'm going to rethink a lot of things in my life, a lot of things. One of the things I'm going to rethink if I live through this is I've done, I think, a pretty good job running this company from zero to 20 billion market cap, whatever it was at the time. It's time for someone else to do it. I don't enjoy it. The stage isn't right for me. As I started getting back on my feet, in my head, I was like, Yamini's doing great. I'm not going to come back. I'm not going to come back. And then when everyone was ready for me to come back, I was like, I'm not coming back. I think she's doing great. And I told my co-founder, I told one of the board members, and they're like, well, when are you going to talk to Yamini? And so I pinged Yamini and I said, I want to talk to you about something. And I said, let's talk on the phone. And we never talk on the phone. And I tell you this because I heard this from her side of the story 2 weeks ago. I had dinner with she and her husband. Her husband's a guy named Cash, who's at Goldman Sachs. He's an analyst at Goldman Sachs. And Yamini went to Cash and she said, oh, Brian wants to talk on the telephone. And Cash said, oh, no, he's about to come back, right? She said, yep. He said, you're probably getting fired. She said, you're probably right. And she went upstairs. She had a phone call. And she's coming down the stairs and she's crying when she's coming down the stairs because I just had offered the CEO job and she's so excited. And Cash looks at her, he's like, I knew it. He fired you, didn't he? Anyway, she did a terrific job when I was out and she was an obvious candidate. And it was perfect in that we had a 6-month trial run with an interim CEO. But I don't recommend people do it that way. I do recommend CEOs ask themselves and boards ask CEOs if they're still happy doing what they're doing. Because I don't think all CEOs are happy or motivated. They're tired. And sometimes you need somebody who's a better stage market fit than you. And I think those conversations probably should happen more often.
Yeah, there's a point. I mean, someone's been doing this, in your case, for a really long time, but even 10 years, there's a point where maybe it just makes sense for the organization to have like a fresh person, a fresh perspective.
Yes.
I'm interested, you know, this call that you had with Yamini, where she thought it was going to be about one thing. We've all gotten these people ping us and they're like, I want to have this call. And I think, oh, we often think it's the worst thing. Like, oh, maybe it's an employee who reaches out to you. Oh, they're going to quit on me. In retrospect, should you just send them a text like, this is good news? Because I often get these things, I'm freaking out. And they're like, oh, it's fine. Like the call is totally fine.
I don't know that I have a good solution to that, but I totally agree with you. When someone pings you out of the blue, you haven't talked to them in 2 months, like, hey, we need to talk. Oh, crap.
Totally. What is it? Also, they have to talk on the phone. Like, could you just been like, hey, we're going to offer you the CEO job. Just, you know, don't go crazy. I don't know what you should do.
You don't want to tell them over text either.
Yeah, that's true. It's a good point.
I will say, hey, before we get into something else, there's a couple things that have worked well for me in the chair role at HubSpot that I think is totally replicable. One is we do 360 reviews of all the board members every year. We basically send a net promoter survey out and what do you think of Lori Norrington as our lead director on a scale of 1 to 10? How much would you recommend her and why? And people write novels. I get all that. I collate it. And then I give them feedback once a year. That is a very healthy dynamic to have.
And obviously you get it on yourself too.
And somebody does it for me, which is super, super helpful. People want feedback. It turns out even board members even get these. As a chairperson, you want to give that feedback. You're also responsible for adding and subtracting. Based on that feedback, if someone's not scaling up with you, as happens, sometimes you have to let them go. People think, oh, I've got the same board forever. You don't have the same board forever. You can upgrade folks as you move along.
I know for public boards, they're often for a term, like a three-year term or something, but you still think it's okay to go to the midterm and say, it's time for you to step down or something?
Yeah, and oftentimes it's their idea. They've gotten weird feedback in the review or, you know, the conversations of the board just don't match their background. They feel it. I do a check-in before board meetings. I think everyone probably does that. And we have a lead director that's really good. This woman, Lori Norrington, is our lead director. And she's a professional board member. We don't have a lot of those. But she was an exec at Intuit and exec at eBay for a long time. But she's been a professional board member for a long time. She's a nom and gov expert. She has been awesome pre-IPO, through the IPO. She's been with us for a long time right now. And she's been a rock for us. So having someone who's really got a lot, one person who's got a ton of board experience is super helpful.
You have a chairperson of the board and a lead director. In some ways, think of them in a similar way. It's like usually when the CEO and chairman is the chairman, then they'll have a lead director. But even when you became chairman, you decided to keep them separate in a way.
They want you to. The investors and the regulators want those to be separate, it turns out. And there's a lot of things regulators want that seem smart but are counterintuitive. That's one of them. There's a whole bunch of rules out there and unsaid rules that if you want to get your proxy statement through and not have any trouble, you want to be thoughtful about.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Now, you and your co-founder, Dharmesh, to me, from the outside, seem to be a perfect pair because you've got very different strengths and you appreciate each other's strengths. Until you left day to day, you guys were with each other for a really long time, which is very rare for co-founders to stick together for so long. What do you attribute some of the staying power to?
Is that true? I thought co-founders stuck together for a long time, generally.
I don't think that's the case. If you think of other super successful companies, there are some, for sure. Sometimes they're brothers, like in Stripe. There are definitely cases, but I think a lot of times, even if you think Paul Allen eventually leaving Microsoft after 6 years, you just see these types of things that happen over time.
Yeah, I think that we've always had from the very beginning a pretty good Venn diagram where I grew up in sales and marketing and had some depth there. And he grew up on the technology side. And we were both really excited about startups and scale-ups. So in the middle is strategy, startups and scale-ups, things in marketing, stuff like that. He was pretty deep on the tech side and I was pretty deep on the go-to-market side. And I think we both respect each other's swim lanes there. And it was 1 + 1 = 3. I'd see a lot of founding teams where the founders are almost identical in background. That certainly worked for a lot of companies, but for us, it was more the Apple type model with Jobs and Wozniak. And I'm no Jobs. And people, like, we are always like, if we could ever grow up, we'd want to be those guys.
He also has an interesting job because I don't even know if he has that many direct reports or something. Like, he's got this very strategic role in the organization.
Zero,
yeah.
So we went to school together, so we knew each other pretty well. And when we decided to start the company together, he said, yeah, no, by the way, I don't want to have any direct reports. I was like, cool, that sounds good. Thinking, no way, pretty soon he's going to have a team and whatnot. And then a couple months in, I was like, okay, we're hiring this developer, it'll be on your team. He's like, no. No direct reports. I'm like, no. Surely you were kidding. He's going to report to you. He's like, nope. And he stuck to that. And he's never had a direct report, I don't know, 17 years in. And he's got a lot of authority and power in the company. And the reason he has it isn't based on the size of his org chart. It's on the size of his brain. And I think that's how HubSpot works. It's your influence is much more about the width of your brain than the width of your org chart.
Interesting. A couple of questions on marketing. Marketing has changed massively in the last 15 years. You talk about being current as a current CEO. If you're in marketing 15 years ago and you left, I don't think you can even recognize a lot of things today. How do you expect it to change in the next 15?
I think it will change as much in the next 15 as the last. Google democratized the access to information. I think AI will democratize the creation of information from search engine optimization to AI optimization. And I think it's going to be like, if you think of things as a funnel, the top of your funnel will probably happen inside of ChatGPT and its competitors. Whereas if you think of the top of funnel now, it kind of happens. People go to Google and then they go to your website to find any detailed information out. But really, if you think of what ChatGPT is doing versus Google, Google's trying to get you off their site and over to your site and convert a click. ChatGPT knows everything that's on your site and more. And so you'll probably stay on there a lot longer and just have a conversation with ChatGPT about your business or any other business. So the top of the funnel is sort of there. Then someone goes to your website And your website is really about the chat functionality on the website. Now people cringe when they get a chatbot on a website, but those are going to get really, really good and really useful. They're going to real time have to wait to talk to a sales rep. And then the website itself, I think of ChatGPT as the top of the funnel. Your website is the middle of the funnel. Chat is the bottom of the funnel. And that whole experience, I think, will change a lot in the coming years. And we're just at the beginning of that. And ChatGPT is really good. It's going to get a lot better. As it gets better, that will be good. The chat on your website is good. It's going to get really good. So all that's going to improve. And it's going to totally turn the thing on its head over the next few years.
Well, not only for marketing, but then actually getting benefit from the product. I think we'll see in a maybe a reverse funnel or something like that.
I think you're right. I think things are going to change more in the next 15 than the last 15. It's going to be really interesting. It's a great time to be in tech. It's a great time to be innovating in tech.
One of the things I really appreciate as a HubSpot user is the UI. It's really easy to use. You can do things quickly. If you think of the main company that you get compared to a lot would be Salesforce. And by contrast, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but in my mouth, I'll say they have terrible UI. And it's not even something they've really, it seems like, ever really invested in. But in some ways, they're still a super amazing company and they've not invested and they have this glaring weakness. Do you think it's important to jump on your weaknesses and make your weaknesses better? Or should you just focus on your strengths as a company?
I think it's a great company, by the way. It's hard for them to create a great user experience because they follow ye old CRM playbook, which is build an app and then acquire a bunch of other apps. All the apps have their own data model database. They all have their own UI. And man, when you get all those acquisitions of big, hairy applications, trying to rationalize all that is really, really hard. And the juice probably isn't worth the squeeze for them to do that. And so they're in a tough spot if they want to become the Apple of the CRM industry. We're big fans of zigging instead of when everyone else is zagging. So we went the opposite way and we built everything. We're trying to make an Apple-like UI, Apple-like buying experience, Apple-like everything, and be the opposite of Salesforce. In some ways, we've really succeeded. In some ways, we have work to do. But I think it's hard for somebody like Salesforce to do that. We knew that Salesforce was hard to use, hard to set up. And so when we were building our CRM, we said, let's make it really easy to use and really easy to set up.
Go the exact opposite route.
Yeah, we tried to go as differentiated as possible for them. So big investment in user experience, big investment in all the things that really matter when it comes to that stuff.
Now, we talked a lot about boards. You briefly mentioned these maybe long-term investors. You mentioned Henry Ellenbogen. What makes a good long-term investor in a company?
On the VC side or the public side?
Let's start with public.
Okay, I think public investors get a bad rap. And when people think of public investors, they think of hedge funds who take short positions or in stocks for a very short amount of time, agitate for CEO replacement and that. The vast, vast majority of public company investors in companies like HubSpot, Atlassian, Google, Facebook, you name it, are, they call them long-only investors. They're big investors. They put hundreds of millions of dollars of HubSpot.
And often it's a fairly large percentage of their fund. It could be 10% of their fund or something like that.
Not really.
No. Okay.
T. Rowe Price has a couple $1 trillion under management. They maybe own $1 billion with HubSpot. It's still round off air. It's not when it comes to Microsoft or Google. But these long-only investors, you end up developing a relationship with them over time. You don't give them any information. You don't give them anyone else. But they start to understand you, understand your patterns, understand if you do what you say you're going to do. And so we've always treated them like we treated the venture investors. Here's our long-term vision. We're going to march towards it. And they've been relatively patient over time. And I'd throw T. Rowe, I'd throw Fidelity, Capital Group, Henry at Durable. There's a whole bunch of them. And I think they generally get a bad rap. I think they're longer term in orientation than a lot of VCs, actually.
Yeah. In some ways, even if you're investing in these very growth companies, that the payoff is potentially decades down the road or something like that, you have to have a long-term view.
The vast majority of VCs will sell within 6 months of the IPO. I mean, Sequoia's got this unusual model where they can hold, which is pretty sweet, actually. I know they get a lot of criticism for it, but I like it.
Why do you like that model where they can move it instead of just, okay, we'll just distribute because they have enough information and the LPs don't, and then they can make a better decision as to when to sell the shares?
I think it's super founder friendly. If you're a CEO, you're about to take your company public, within 6-12 months, all your venture capitalists who own most of your company are dumping all of those shares, except for one who's going to hold on and maybe buy more. I think that's a very attractive thing that they have for entrepreneurs. they caught a lot of flack for it, but it's attractive. And I think of our relationship with Sequoia, they invested a $250 million valuation. We went public at $1 billion. Now it's worth $23 billion. With a company like HubSpot, that strategy really pays off.
Yeah, it really pays off. Yeah. Or if you're like in Shopify or something like that, that would have been amazing. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. But on the flip side, because when I've been LPs in funds and they go public, they don't sell, they distribute the shares. And then I can make a decision on my own what to do. And often I'm not going to sell because your tax basis is so high. Of course, maybe a foundation doesn't care about taxes and stuff. Then you're still become long-term holders.
I think the argument's really good there that Sequoia, when we went public, and you can argue many years later, doesn't know a lot about HubSpot, but within a year of going public, they certainly knew a lot more about HubSpot than, let's say, T. Rowe did.
Now, you routinely call HubSpot a West Coast company on the East Coast. What does that really mean?
Okay, two things that jump to mind on that. I think of West Coast company as very first principles in nature and skeptical of conventional wisdom. And really from the jump, Dharmesh and I really thought that way. We were very, very skeptical of received wisdom and we're not afraid to rethink things from scratch. Who's your target market? It was a big one that we rethought. How's your culture work? Was a big one that we rethought. Many, many things we rethought. And it's worked out well for us. And when we go to the West Coast, we still do an annual field trip from headquarters, the whole management team of the West Coast. It was that first principles thinking that we always really respected. It drove people crazy at times. It drove our investors crazy at times. It drove new execs who bring from the outside crazy from times. And sometimes conventional wisdom, just the right answer. But I like the way the West Coast is skeptical of conventional wisdom.
So it's like questioning what's already happened or something.
I'll give you an example. HubSpot started in SMB, small, medium businesses. Every venture capitalist in the world hated that idea. And getting through that objection was really, really painful. And there's a lot of scars around that. And our argument was really simple. Yes, we know everybody else goes to the enterprise. Yes, we know a lot of companies haven't been successful in small businesses. Here's why it makes sense today. You can acquire companies much more easily. The business model is well known that you can upsell your way out of the hole if people churn. The internet disproportionately was benefiting small businesses relative to large businesses. So we had a whole playbook and reasoning behind it. And some people just wanted to put us in the box. Again, give credit to Sequoia. I remember we raised our round for Sequoia Series D. We met with every big investor on Sand Hill Road and got no's. And if Sequoia said no, we didn't have a backup. We would have had an inside round. Those guys listened to it and were like, okay, let's do SMB. Sounds good.
Why do you think they took the contrarian to Sand Hill Road approach?
I don't know, but I suppose they do that a lot.
That's why they're so successful.
Yeah.
We have two questions that we ask all of our guests. First of all, what is a conspiracy theory that you believe?
I'm not a one or a zero in any of them, but I'm like a coin flip on all the murder ones. JFK,
Jeffrey Epstein.
Lady Di.
Yep.
In all three of those cases, there were very powerful, deep-pocketed people who wanted to silence them. So if I were to believe any of them, it's that troika.
Okay. I like those. Those are fun. Okay. Last question we ask all of our guests. What conventional wisdom or advice do you think is generally bad advice?
Okay. You brought this up earlier. Everyone says, work on your weaknesses. Give it strengths. I think you shouldn't work on your weaknesses. And you should advise people on your team not to work on your weaknesses. You should hire around your weaknesses and work on your strengths. If you've got a great strength around public speaking, you've got a great strength around product development or product vision, go very deep there because you're probably passionate about it and very good at it. And there's more leverage in that than trying to fix your weaknesses. So I've stayed away from my weaknesses and always tried to hire people around me that fill in my weaknesses. And I try to advise others of that.
I have a friend who's an incredibly successful CEO. And he not only thinks he's bad at public speaking, but he hates it. So he basically doesn't do it, which is pretty rare for a CEO. And everyone's always, you got to go to this coach. And he's a great written communicator. He's great at communicating in many, many other ways. It's actually served him well by being able to clearly say, this is something I'm not good at and I'm not going to go do. It's been interesting instead of just getting all the coaches that everyone else ends up doing.
Yeah, F the coaches. I'll tell you another thing relative. Learning how to write well in a convincing way is underrated. Whether you're writing in Slack, or you're writing on your wiki, or you're writing on Twitter, or you're writing a thought piece. Dharmesh and I wrote our way to success and still write a lot. And so if you don't like public speaking, and I think a lot of people don't like public speaking, you can get away with that if you're a really good writer.
Yeah, communication. As a CEO, you probably do need to communicate somehow. And that's probably a very important thing to have as a CEO. But there's probably many different mediums to enable you to do that.
If you're introverted and you really hate the microphone, really get good at writing.
Yeah, that makes sense. Oh, this has been awesome. I'm a huge fan of yours. So I'm so excited that you're on here. Thank you, Brian and Halligan, for joining us at World of Dask. By the way, I follow you on Twitter, X, or whatever, at B. Halligan. I definitely encourage our listeners to engage you there. This has been a ton of fun.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, consider rating this podcast and leaving a review. For more World of Dask, and Dask is DAAS, you can subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your podcasts. And also check out YouTube for videos. You can find me at Twitter at Auren, that's A-U-R-E-N, Auren, and we'd love to hear from you. World of Dask is brought to you by Safegraph. Safegraph is geospatial data for physical places. Check it out at safegraph.com. And by Flex Capital. Flex Capital invests in data companies like those we talk about at World of Dask. Check it out at flexcapital.com.